gas stoves recently? They've caused a firestorm.
All the stars have aligned to realize this is a problem. It's a health threat, especially to children.
But no, gas stoves are not banned, and few are switching to electric on their own. That story is next on WGLT's Sound Ideas. Good afternoon, I'm John Norton, also on the show, the latest in WGLT's Welcome Home series. A little snow, no big deal for seasoned Central Illinois drivers, but if you're not from around here, it could be a white-knuckle commute.
Yeah, I honestly feel bad for other people who have to share the road with me, but I'm trying.
A new study urges regenerative agriculture to reduce farmers' carbon footprint. Plus, Illinois lawmakers approve new rules that limit local control of siting wind and solar farms. Those stories follow a Bloomington Normal News update, which is next. This is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas, on 89.1 FM and WGLT.org.
Support for WGLT comes from Bloomington Normal Audiology. BNA's educational video series, Hear My Story, continues with local patient Jerry Newkirk.
Being able to adjust for different situations, noisy environments, it's incredible. It's been a blessing.
Jerry's full story can be found at bnaudiology.com.
From the campus of Illinois State University in Normal, this is WGLT's news magazine, Sound Ideas. I'm John Norton. On today's show, you'll hear the latest in WGLT's Welcome Home series, how transplants get used to driving here in Central Illinois during the wintertime. That's up in just a bit. But first, gas stoves have been in the news a lot lately, and in Illinois in particular, there are a lot of them around. WGLT's Lindsay Jones breaks down what exactly is going on.
It all started with a study published in the International Journal of Environmental Research and Public Health last month. Researchers were trying to determine the correlation between childhood asthma rates and negative air quality from natural gas inside the house, a byproduct of cooking with a gas stove, for instance. Ultimately, researchers determined that nearly 13% of currently known cases of childhood asthma in the U.S. are attributable to pollution generated by gas stoves. And in Illinois, where gas stoves are in abundance, that percentage of childhood asthma tied to natural gas is more than 20%, the highest rate of all states included in the researchers' study. What's new about this information is not the fact that methane emissions impact air quality indoors, or even that it contributes to childhood asthma, as Brian Urbicheski of the Chicago-based Respiratory Health Association explains.
People have known for a long time that what comes out of gas stoves is potentially dangerous. Gas stoves pollute even when they're not operating. They leak gas into your home. There's some things that are toxic in gas, like benzene, that have been documented.
What was innovative about last month's study was the extent to which it quantified or measured how stoves impact children's asthma rates, effectively demonstrating that intervention measures could reduce the rate of asthma in kids.
So I think this is really just a moment where things have sort of crystallized and, you know, all the stars have aligned to realize that this is a problem. It's a health threat, especially to children. And what can we do about it?
Those proposed intervention measures are what's really ignited the gas stove discourse. Rebecca Lieber is a reporter with Vox Media who has extensively written about and investigated the natural gas industry.
In December, the Consumer Product Safety Commission talked about what it can start to do around gas stoves. So basically, the agency, which is independent from the Biden administration, said it was going to start having public hearings, looking at the science here and looking at its options.
Lieber says an offhand comment from the head of the Consumer Product Safety Commission is what led some people, like reactionary politicians and talking heads on TV, to claim the government plans to forcibly remove gas stoves from homes.
Commissioner Richard Trumka Jr. gave an interview that got a lot of attention because he said any option is on the table, including a potential ban on gas appliances. The agency quickly walked this back, saying that there is no ban under consideration.
And if, hypothetically, there were to be some sort of wide sweeping ban on gas stoves, it's likely something that would apply only to the new manufacturing of appliances or new buildings. In fact, local governments across the country have been trying to move away from natural gas power and pivot to electricity in efforts to reduce climate impact. And electrification is not good news for gas companies.
These gas utilities make a lot of their money from new customers and new lines to buildings. So that's why talking about electrification is so important to the industry, because if you're talking about banning gas appliances from new construction, you're kind of cutting off the lifeline for the industry.
Rebecca Lieber's investigative reporting has shown that major gas utilities have been fighting electrification for some time. In red states like Texas, Indiana, and Iowa, Lieber says the gas utilities have flexed their lobbying muscles and helped get what are called preemption laws on state books. Those laws ensure that local governments cannot enact any sort of ban on gas appliances in new buildings. Of 50 states, 20 so far have passed such laws. Illinois is not among them. Lieber says her reporting found that gas utilities also in recent years have paid outside public relations firms to get social media influencers to promote cooking with gas and raise its popularity.
They were reacting to my original story on this, and one of the executives said something like, they should not stop for even 1 hour. If they're saying we are paying influencers to gush over gas stoves, so be it. Of course we are. Maybe we should pay them to gush more.
Gas-powered appliances are ubiquitous in some areas, like in Illinois, thanks to the availability of natural gas and, until recently, its lower cost. Bob Brady is the president of local home building company Keystone Homes. He says in his experience in the McLean County area, people building new homes haven't wanted electric appliances. Instead, they tend to opt for gas more often than not.
I'll just tell you this. We would love to build green, and 99% of the people want to build green, but 99.9% don't want to pay for it.
Brady says for many new home builders, costs prompt them to go with gas instead of going green, although prices trending upward may curb that.
Typically, gas is a lot less and more efficient, you know, but this past year it's gone obviously through the roof.
Environmental leaders say there is some relief to be found in the Inflation Reduction Act. Michael Brown of the Ecology Action Center in Normal says his agency works with clients to make homes more energy efficient, and some provisions in that act can help financially.
But that upfront cost can be a barrier to a lot of households. I do believe there is some funding coming through the Inflation Reduction Act. It covers some of these costs for those transitions to help remove some of those barriers.
And if you're wondering what the local impact of gas appliances are on the environment, Brown says the EAC has analyzed this using data from 2008 and 2015.
Natural gas usage in particular is about 21% of our greenhouse gas emissions for Bloomington and Normal, which is specifically about 438,000 metric tons of carbon dioxide equivalents.
Brian Urbacheski of the National Respiratory Health Association says, yes, climate change is driving a significant chunk of the discourse surrounding gas stoves and going green. But as the president of an organization dedicated to health, he'd like to circle back to what really got things started. Childhood asthma rates. The current number in Illinois is about 260,000.
If this study is anywhere near accurate and it says that 20% of over 20% of asthma could be due to exposure to gas stoves, that's a significant number of children. If we're looking at things like gas stoves that are in almost every home in Illinois, you know, trying to address that is something that can help bring those numbers down.
A representative from the Illinois Environmental Council says leaders here do not anticipate an all-out ban on gas stoves in the state anytime soon, although decarbonization efforts will remain a priority. I'm Lindsay Jones.
Coming up on Sound Ideas, a new study showing how farmers can preserve their fields and help protect the environment with regenerative agriculture. That's about 5 minutes away. Now, even with the few inches of snow we got yesterday, this has been a relatively merciful winter, at least so far. And that's good news for those people who have recently moved to Bloomington Normal from warmer climates. They are not accustomed to the nail-biting experience of winter driving. As part of WGLT's ongoing series, Welcome Home, WGLT's Ryan Denham goes back to Driver's Ed for some winter driving 101.
This is Anna Twitty's first real Midwest winter. She moved to Bloomington in late October from central North Carolina, where she grew up, to take a job at Illinois State University. Anna is nervous about her first season of winter driving. She's planning to even leave her old plates on her car for the time being. So if you see a Toyota Corolla with North Carolina plates inching its way through Bloomington Normal, you might want to cut her some slack.
At least I feel like that will give people a good signal on the road to like give me a wide berth if stuff's happening. I don't know. I mostly feel bad for other people who have to share the road with me, but I'm trying.
This winter has not been too bad around here in central Illinois, other than that pre-Christmas deep freeze. Anna was back in North Carolina and missed that, though she got a dose of frigid reality when she flew back to Central Illinois Regional Airport and went to drive home. Her trunk was frozen shut, and then unexpectedly popped open the next day while driving on Veterans.
It was really funny, and like again, like I've never had to think about that kind of thing before. People were like, oh, you can get like de-icer and stuff for it, and I was like, what?
Anna is not alone. Whether you're new to winter driving or a seasoned pro, I think we can all learn a little something from Steve Price. He is a driver's education instructor at Normal West High School. Steve's number one tip is to slow down. Speed is your number one enemy. After safely navigating a few winter storms, Price says it is tempting to want to drive like it's sunny and clear outside. But slow down. Let off your accelerator sooner when you're approaching an intersection where many accidents happen.
Normally a good 3 second fouling distance underneath ideal conditions, so you're going to have to increase that. Knowing when it rains, it's going to take you twice as long to stop. And when you throw snow and ice in, there's really no other comparison.
Tip number two, clear your vehicle. Take the time to clear off your roof, windows, headlights, taillights. Yes, it's annoying. Yes, it's time-consuming, but it helps you drive safe and is also good winter driving etiquette.
Some people you see going down the road, it looks like a snowstorm in itself because they didn't clear those windows and those rooftops off.
Anna Twitty is already practicing this one. She bought herself a serious snow brush and ice scraper and is building in some snow and ice clearing time in her commute.
I assume like the more I do it, the less it'll stick out to me as a hassle, if that makes any sense. And, you know, I'm already like getting better at my scraping form, I guess.
Steve's tip number three, be careful on bridges. They can be extra slippery.
Where the airflow is underneath and they tend to freeze and thaw and refreeze, and salt is on those areas, but necessarily there's going to be those slick spots.
Tip number four, skidding. Let's say you are driving slow, but you still start skidding during a turn. What should you do?
Definitely turn in the direction of the skid. So, for instance, if your back end is swinging to the right, you would turn your wheel to the right. However, eventually, you're going to have to bring your wheel back to that home position once the car straightens out. If not, and you leave that wheel turned, then you're going to begin to fishtail.
Tip number five, avoid snow plows and salt trucks. If you see a plow or salt truck nearby or their lights, slow down, give them space. Move to the left lane if they're in the right lane. It's also inadvisable to really pass them. Here's Chris Blaney, one of Central Illinois' most experienced snow plow drivers for the Illinois Department of Transportation.
When I'm driving that truck, I got people I know coming by honking at me, calling me on, hey man, I saw you driving. I cannot hear or pay attention to anything but what I'm doing. So your headlights are in a pile of snow behind me.
Tip number six, the last one on our list, is to get ready before it snows. Steve recommends preparing a winter driving kit for your vehicle. That should include things like a small folding shovel, extra wiper fluid and antifreeze, and some road salt or cat litter for traction. Reporting from the frozen tundra, I'm Ryan Denham.
You can find more tips, including explanations for snow routes, parking bans, and collision alerts at WGLT.org. And you can see more stories in our Welcome Home series focused on those who have recently moved to Bloomington Normal at WGLT.org/welcome. The state of Illinois has set new rules from citing wind and solar farms that take away some local control. More on that on Sound Ideas in about 5 minutes. Next up, a recent study by the Illinois agricultural not-for-profit Basil's Harvest, extolling the benefits regenerative agriculture practices can have for soil health. WGLT Ag correspondent Tim Alexander recently spoke to founder and president Aaron Meyer and consulting scientist Carl Rozier about why adopting those practices can benefit both farmers and the environment.
We limit trying to break up the soil at significant depths below the plow layer. So sometimes you'll see farmers they'll do some cultivation, which kind of is basically meant to knock down weeds. But the basic principle is no deep or hard turning over of the soil. Because the minute that you turn that soil over, you break that soil up, you break up those aggregates that I was talking about earlier. Once those aggregates are broken up, that carbon is exposed, that was entombed and secured. Now it becomes available for microorganisms to start to react to it, and then that adds carbon to the atmosphere. So no-till is a big one. Cover cropping is huge. We really advocate for farmers to cover crop as much as possible. Cover cropping, it does two things, really. It adds that organic matter, that carbon, back to the soil, but it also holds the soil in place. So by holding the soil in place, it limits water and wind erosion. And also the use of legume cover crops is really big. So legumes are great because they add the cover crop, or they add the cover, so they give you that resistance to rain and wind erosion, but they also fix nitrogen. So these little microbes that live on the root, those are just some of the things that farmers that practice conservation practices, I think that can span anywhere from being organic to even, more conventional farmers practicing those things can add organic matter to the soil.
These are not exactly brand new findings or concepts, Aaron, but why is it, do you feel, important right now for farmers to be able to embrace this concept and actually put these production practices onto their operations?
One, we need to improve the health of the soil, the biology of the soil, to improve plant health, which will improve the end product, we hope, which then will provide a more nutrient-dense food source for us to consume. The other piece, we look at climate change and the way that we've been farming and the impact that industrial agriculture is having on climate. Regenerative organic practices can improve greenhouse gas emissions.
Carl, what are some of the stumbling blocks that prohibit some farmers from being able to become fully involved in these regenerative agricultural practices like cover cropping? And are there any federal or state programs that can help these producers take the bite out of some of the expense of getting started with these practices?
Yeah, I mean, that's a great question. I mean, there are programs to help cover the cost of seed, and there's even some programs that will help reimburse on equipment purchases. It can be really expensive, and it can be time-consuming. And then I've also heard, I've had a few farmers say to me, like, oh, today's cover crop is tomorrow's wheat. You're constantly managing this thing and hoping that it doesn't get out of sorts to where it costs you more revenue than maybe you're prepared to spend. So a large part of it is the technical assistance and understanding like what cover crop you should purchase and how to plant it and how to terminate it. The equipment, a lot of the equipment we use to terminate cover crops, and I mean, it's hard to get a hold of now. This was stuff that we were doing in the golden age of farming before we could make nitrogen fertilizer. Mm-hmm. So a lot of that is no longer exists, and they're kind of bringing it back. And then the equipment in itself is incredibly expensive. A good cultivator can cost $50,000 to $100,000 easy. For a really good one with all the bells and whistles, with the cameras and the crop protect, they're incredibly expensive. But yeah, so there are state and government programs to help offset some of that. And, we can get into the carbon markets. It'd be great if the carbon markets stabilized and they kind of figured out how important cover cropping is and some of these land management practices to storing carbon in the soil to mitigate climate change.
You make a good point that with these emerging carbon markets, that farmers are going to need to be able to prove these regenerative agricultural practices to be able to get on board with that exciting new frontier in agriculture. Aaron, what is the next step in your research?
We've got this first paper that's been released, and we submitted more soil samples last year to the University of Delaware to analyze. We've got that data back, really looking at the biology of the soil and to provide us the information to create another educational document that will be for farmers. The other piece of this is, you know, as we start to talk about this type of agriculture and we talk about human health.
That was Aaron Meyer of Basil's Harvest and scientist Carl Rozier speaking with WGLT ag correspondent Tim Alexander about regenerative farming.
Support for WGLT agriculture coverage comes from GrowMark and its FS members, your trusted advisor in all your ag decisions.
And you can check out WGLT's agriculture reporting on our website, WGLT.org. It's under the Food and Farming tab. A bill awaiting Governor J.B. Pritzker's signature would set statewide standards for wind and solar farm siting. In our final story on WGLT Sound Ideas, Tim Shelley from our sister station WCBU explains.
Until now, counties have enjoyed wide latitude in setting the standards for where wind and solar energy arrays can locate. Jen Walling is executive director of the Illinois Environmental Council. She says some county requirements were so restrictive that they were essentially bans on clean energy developments.
A number of these counties weren't representing their constituents and were taking away individual property rights.
The Illinois Farm Bureau was opposed to House Bill 4412. Director of State Legislation Kevin Semlow says the group finds the legislation lacking in some areas.
Some of the setback distances within the legislation need to be adjusted to better reflect a much safer an adequate way that those facilities should be sited.
The Farm Bureau also wants to see changes on drainage and compliance enforcement issues. State Senator Dave Kaler was a co-sponsor of the legislation. He says it's a good compromise measure.
I think that this is a good attempt to kind of strike a balance between a state standard and local control.
Walling says environmental groups work closely with Governor J.B. Pritzker's office on the bill, and she expects it to be signed into law. I'm Tim Shelley.
And that's Sound Ideas today. WGLT's news magazine is made possible in part by Bloomington Normal Audiology. I'm John Norton with story help today from Tim Shelley, also ag correspondent Tim Alexander. We had help from Ryan Denham, who braved the winter storm, winter weather yesterday for a story, and for Lindsay Jones, bringing us the heated topic of gas stoves. The show today produced exquisitely as usual by Samantha Hill. This is 89.1 FM WGLT and WGLT.org, Bloomington Normal's public media.